About 15 billion years ago, there were no stars in the sky. There wasn't even a sky. All that existed was the primordial fireball. That fireball of energy condensed into the simplest building blocks of matter at the birth of our universe. What were those fundamental entities from which the stars and galaxies have been built? Physicists are trying to answer that question by taking matter apart, looking at the pieces. In effect, looking back in time at the earliest stages of creation. Nearly 200 years ago, we discovered the atom. Then, 60 years ago, inside the atom, we found the nucleus. And inside the nucleus, something smaller still, the proton. Today, we're probing inside the proton. Inside it, there may be bizarre creations called quarks. It almost seems a paradox that the smaller the thing you're looking for, the bigger the instrument you need. This one, sited near San Francisco, is 2 miles long. Near Geneva, the mysteries of the atom are probed in this gigantic laboratory. It straddles the Swiss-French border. This is where the search for the quarks begins. Protons, the diminutive hearts of hydrogen atoms, are fired from this room at almost the speed of light. The whole machine has a 2-second pulse. In those 2 seconds, bursts of protons traveling in a giant circle will cross the Swiss-French border nearly 2 million times. The protons race along tunnels shielded by vast concrete blocks and then shatter themselves by smashing into other protons. The machine tortures matter. Picture by picture, we catch glimpses of how the universe looked a few minutes after the creation. The particles produced in these collisions are much too small to be seen. Their presence is revealed only by the tracks they leave behind them as they pass through the detecting equipment. These patterns, the lengths and shapes of these tracks, describe the life histories of particles. Some of them live only a few billionths of a second, and the tracks are the only evidence of their fleeting existence. Interpreting these pictures, deciding what they tell us about the universe, needs colossal imagination. The finest scientific minds of our time.
I call it sometimes the greatest adventure of the human mind, which is the discovery to penetrate as far as possible, to understand as much as possible about his universe, and what he's made out of, and what matter is made out of, that this is just like a great exploration.
The simple equipment that started this exploration is a far cry from today's multi-million pound experiments. In 1947, physicists from the University of Bristol were using balloons to carry photographic film high into the upper atmosphere to study the high-energy cosmic rays hitting the Earth. Compared to today, the methods looked makeshift. Bags of sand served as ballast. During the flight, the film carried by the balloon recorded the cosmic rays that bombard the Earth. Each star pattern was made by protons in the cosmic rays hitting the atoms in the sensitive film. The discoveries that were made by this novel technique revealed totally unexpected behavior in the realms of the atom.
What's interesting is that these properties of atoms that we found here are the same, we have found out, as the properties of atoms on the stars. It's the same atoms. It's a universe that we're looking at. So we're not just exploring a little thing. And many people go very deep, and it looks smaller and smaller. It's only small in dimension. As far as the universe is concerned, it's all-encompassing. It's universal. So it's a tremendous adventure. It's apparently important. It's the result of curiosity. It's impossible to stop.
The urge to know more led to the building of the large atom-smashing machines. They started building this machine at Brookhaven in New York in 1952. It cost $3.5 million. Its purpose was not to produce bombs, not to find better energy sources, not even to find a cure for cancer. Scientific curiosity was the sole reason for its construction. And we're still curious because these machines don't give us all the answers. Instead, they reveal new complexities that make us even more curious. And so we're still building atom smashers, or, to use the physicist's jargon word, accelerators. Here in Geneva, alongside the existing machines, a new accelerator is being built. 12 European nations split the cost of this research between themselves. Each British taxpayer contributes an amount equivalent to the cost of 2 cups of coffee a year. The total cost will be £80 million. The new accelerator will dwarf the existing machines. It'll be nearly 5 miles in circumference. At the moment, it's just a vast civil engineering project. The tunnel that will contain the accelerator is being driven 100 feet below the ground. When it's finished in 1978, protons, they're a 10 million millionth of a centimeter in diameter, will be accelerated through the tunnel at enormous speeds, so fast that they'll appear to have gained mass. They'll do this because accelerators are relativity machines. The nearer the speed of light you get, the heavier you seem to become. When they emerge, protons will be 400 times heavier than when they went in.
The protons, when they are accelerated at their full energy, are extracted from that machine in certain places. And one of these places is at the end of this tunnel here. This tunnel is one of the extraction tunnels. It's a transfer tunnel which allows us to bring out the particles from the machine to the experimental areas.
The tunneling operations require the movement of about 400,000 cubic yards of rock, and it has to be done with an unprecedented precision. The tunnel has to be a perfect circle to within a matter of 3 or 4 inches in 5 miles. The underground work is necessary because the accelerator is sensitive to the minutest movement in the ground. The instruments at Geneva were able to detect the vibrations in the ground due to the pounding of the waves on the Bay of Biscay, 400 miles away. While excavation continues, the components that will be put in the tunnel are being assembled. The accelerator needs 1,000 of these large electromagnets to guide the protons through the tunnel. Utmost precision and scrupulous cleanliness are needed here if the accelerator is to perform up to specification. Each magnet, British made, weighs about 18 tons. The bill for the magnets alone will be £11 million. Every detail is considered. A committee decided that the magnets should be painted red. Every piece of the new accelerator pushes technology to its limit. Using these ultra-precise instruments, how do you find out if there are quarks inside a proton?
The way we do find out about this proton, the first kind of experiments that we've been making, is to tear the electron off the atom and accelerate the proton faster and faster and let it plow into a mass of atoms, into a piece of ordinary matter, hoping it'll hit one of the other protons in, say, hydrogen gas. And then see what happens, what comes out. It would be like trying to find out what a watch is made out of and how the mechanism works. By the expedient of smashing two watches together and seeing what kinds of gear wheels fly out.
When one proton hits another proton, pieces do seem to come out, but in an extraordinary profusion. Two protons in collision may create as many as 20 or more proton-like particles. Matter has been created in this process from the energy of the incoming proton. What comes out is not simply fragments of the proton. Instead, we see brothers and sisters of the proton, particles just as complex as the proton itself. The problem was to account for this multifarious collection.
The experimental physicists using the giant accelerators have, during the course of the last 20 years, discovered an enormous number of particle states. But no one believes that all of these are, in any sense, fundamental particles. And we theoreticians have, during the same period of time, been hard at work trying to discover a simple picture. If there are fundamental entities, they must be few in number and arranged in some simple and beautiful pattern. And the search for that pattern led us 10 years ago to the notion of the quark.
How did the theoreticians come to think of quarks from this profusion of particles? Their thought processes have strong parallels in other branches of science. Just think of the profusion of living things. At first, we're almost overwhelmed by the multiplicity of forms. The innocent eye only sees the diversity of shapes and colors in the butterflies. Then we begin to see relationships between them. Some butterflies have similar shapes, some similar colorations. They fall into families, and those families into smaller groups. 100 years ago, the chemical elements were intractable. Some family relationships were known. Sodium acted like potassium, chlorine like bromine, and so on. Was there any order here? The great Russian chemist Mendeleev was able to construct the whole pattern, the periodic table. He'd been searching for a neat way to teach the properties of the elements to his students, and he devised a table of family groups. But at Mendeleev's time, only 60 of the 92 stable elements were known, and Mendeleev realized that there should be gaps in the pattern. He was able to predict the physical properties of 3 of the missing elements, and his predictions turned out to be unbelievably accurate. About 15 years ago, among the particles, there was a need for a new kind of Mendeleev table, especially in a group called the hadrons, the group to which the proton and neutron belong. It was among these that the theorists were trying to find family relationships.
To a surprising degree, we were successful. We found, according to one scheme, which worked, that there could be patterns of families, so to speak, of ones and eights and tens among the hadrons. The neutron and proton belong to an eight. And just above them in energy, there's a family with 10 members. About 10 years ago, 11 years ago, the lowest family of eight to which the neutron and proton belong was complete, and we were just thinking about a 10, the possibility of a family containing 10 members. I remember at a meeting in Geneva in 1962, I was just scribbling something about such a pattern, 10, when at that moment I heard an experimentalist announce to the meeting the discovery of what could be 2 of the missing members of that family. And I jumped up and suggested at the meeting that a search be made for the final missing member, the so-called omega minus particle. 2 young experimental physicists from the Brookhaven laboratory came to me and asked me to write the little statement for them, which I wrote on a napkin. And they took it in that form to the director of their lab, who authorized the experiment.
We started to perform the experiment in earnest in November of 1963. In fact, we started tuning the beam round the clock, 24 hours a day. It certainly wasn't smooth sailing. We had many difficulties.
The kind of track the omega minus would leave had been predicted by Professor Gell-Mann. It was now up to the experimenters to try and find it among their photographs.
Of course, as soon as we had these pictures, we started scanning them, again looking for these patterns. We scanned 10, 20, 30,000, still no omega. Finally, went to roll 53 and picture number 97,025. That number stays in everyone's mind around here. And finally, we found the omega. This little particle, this little 3-centimeter particle, this was the omega we spent months, years looking for.
What Mendeleev had done for chemistry, Gell-Mann had now done for physics. Both had predicted the behavior of some missing member of incomplete families, and the experimenters had confirmed their predictions. The question now was, why should this family exist?
Many of us searched about for some way of accounting for the whole structure that we could see in terms of a fundamental subunit. And 2 of us hit on the same notion at the same time, George Zweig and I.
we were both from Caltech and both on leave. He was in Geneva, Switzerland, and I was in Boston in 1963. And independently, we hit on this notion that an elementary subunit called, which I called the quark, could explain the whole pattern.
If quarks were to be one of the universe's fundamental building blocks, the constituents of protons, they had to have some very specific properties. To start with, they had to be simple. They couldn't be made out of anything else. But the quarks also had to have a special, rather peculiar property.
They behave as if they have fractional electric charges in units of the proton's charge, namely 2/3, minus 1/3, and minus 1/3. A very queer notion.
This was the audacious concept of the quarks. Up to that time, no one had thought that electric charge could be split up. The three quarks on the fruit machine can give us all the particles in the family that the neutron and proton belong to. This combination, minus 1/3, plus 2/3, plus 2/3, makes a charge of 1, the proton. A slightly different arrangement, minus 1/3, minus 1/3, plus 2/3, makes the charge of 0, a neutron. One by one, the three quarks can be put together to form all the members of the proton family. The whole pattern is formed by different arrangements of these three simple entities, the quarks.
Many people have taken literally the simple notion that the quarks, with their fractional charges, actually can be detected as separable entities in the laboratory and have searched for them.
The theorists have wondered about how you can get quarks. Well, they're supposed to be the building blocks of protons and neutrons. In order to create them, we have to knock the protons and neutrons apart into the pieces. This will take a very high-energy particle. Very high-energy particles are striking the Earth continuously in the form of cosmic rays. So one theory is that these cosmic rays can knock the protons and neutrons apart.
As the earlier balloon experiment has found out, cosmic rays are always hitting the atoms in the upper atmosphere. Some create cascades of particles that eventually hit the ground. The industrial haze over the West Riding of Yorkshire presents no barrier, and some of them fall on the physics department of Leeds University. In a joint experiment with Michigan University, they've built an instrument that should reveal if there are quarks among the shower of particles. The instrument is called a cloud chamber. It's basically a large box that contains an inert gas saturated with alcohol vapor. When a particle shower passes through the chamber, a piston is triggered. This expands the gas and it cools by 40 degrees. Where the particles have passed through the chamber, droplets of alcohol condense in their wake, forming droplet tracks. By photographing the tracks, the lead scientists hope to see evidence of a quark having gone through the chamber.
We would expect to find the quarks very close to the center of the cores of extensive air showers. Here we have the core of a rather small extensive air shower, and yet we see that the particle density is far too high, probably for our scanners to be able to detect the much thinner tracks that we would expect from a quark particle.
The scanners are housewives who search diligently through the photographs as a part-time occupation. They're looking for the very thin tracks that quarks should leave among a virtual bird's nest of other tracks. And if that's not enough, the lead scientists have developed a sneaky way of testing just how good the scanning ladies are at quark spotting.
We superimpose on certain pictures, when our scanners are not looking, artificial tracks which look as near as we can to what we think a 1/3 charge quark track would look like. And these are made simply by putting an aluminium foil with pinholes suitably pricked in front of a small fluorescent strip lamp. And then by means of a simple mirror arrangement, we superimpose these pinholes, illuminated pinholes, on the original shower photograph so that they in fact appear as though it was a track actually down in the volume of the cloud chamber among all the shower tracks. And then we check the efficiency of our scanners by whether they see such an artificial track or miss it.
Various scanners have different methods. Some start at the top, some start at the bottom. It can take as little as 10, 15 minutes, or it can take anything up to an hour.
We wondered if it would be boring, but it's far more interesting, I find, than I thought it would be originally. I didn't know a lot about it before I came. I don't think any of us did, really. But we keep learning more, and we're shown the cloud chamber and have more explained to us. And we feel it's really important, because if we do find the quark, well, it'll really make history, won't it?
We've photographed about 15,000 showers. However, because of the major scanning problem, perhaps only 3,000 photographs of these have yet been efficiently searched. And so far, we've found no indication of quarks being present.
It has also been suggested that in the early history of the universe was a very hot, small fireball, and matter was moving with such high velocities that the protons and the neutrons were broken into their constituent pieces, quarks, if quarks exist. If that were true, then there must be some of the parts left around, even today.
So any piece of ordinary matter, even on Earth, should contain a few free quarks. And Professor Fairbank has devised a sophisticated way of searching for them.
This is the apparatus with which we are trying to determine whether or not there are quarks on matter. We use as our matter a very tiny niobium sphere. The sphere is about a quarter the size of the ball in a ballpoint pen. We place the sphere in a little cup and move the cup to the center of two parallel condenser plates.
When an alternating voltage is applied to the condenser plates, the ball, if it carries electric charge, is driven up and down. The idea is to try to make the ball electrically neutral, to make it stay still. Adding whole units of positive charge makes the situation worse in this case. Bringing in a negative source subtracts units of charge from the ball and reduces its movement. But if the ball cannot be made to stay still by adding or subtracting charge, the physicists argue that there must be some fraction of charge, a quark, on the ball. In fact, in his first experiments, Professor Fairbank found one ball that did continue to move up and down.
There's no question about it. We found non-zero forces when the ball was neutralized. But the question we have to answer is, did these forces represent quarks, or did they represent spurious dipole-type forces?
Professor Fairbank is one of the most able experimenters in the United States. And to ensure that he hasn't been observing spurious effects, his research student has redesigned and rebuilt the original apparatus. The whole apparatus will work at a temperature of a few degrees above absolute zero and will be encased in electric and magnetic shielding to remove any possibility of outside interference. What are the chances that he will observe a real quark?
One never knows how many things will go wrong with an experiment, but we're very hopeful that we will know a great deal during the 1974.
It's increasingly unlikely that these fractionally charged quarks exist as separable entities, but that was never a necessary part of the scheme, and that was clear from the beginning.
To date, no one has any conclusive evidence that quarks exist as separate entities. But why not look for them where they should exist, actually inside the proton? To do that needs instruments that can resolve extremely fine detail. At Stanford in California, a rather special type of electron microscope has been used to probe inside the proton. What's special about this instrument is its size. What you're looking at is merely the target. The rest of the machine stretches back over 2 miles. Even for an experimenter driving a fast car, it's a long ride. Yet the electrons that fly along the accelerator do the journey in 1/100,000th of a second. The technique of using high-energy electrons to detect the structure of protons was developed at Stanford by Professor Robert Hofstadter, work for which he was awarded the 1961 Nobel Prize for Physics. One of his colleagues continuing this line of research, Professor Richard Taylor.
Now, when I came here 25 years ago to Stanford, Professor Hofstadter was just learning how to use electrons as projectiles to do scattering experiments on the proton. In those experiments, what he found was that the proton had a size, okay, that the proton was not a point, but had a size, very small, but a size. Then, that was very exciting because as soon as something has a size, physicists think just like anybody else, if it has a size, you must be able to take it apart. It must have pieces, and so there should be something smaller.
So that has just whetted our appetite for more information. And so we tried another series of experiments of somewhat similar nature. Instead of measuring electrons that come out with the same energy as come in, we measure them where the electrons that come out have lost some energy. And the reason they lose energy is because they're bouncing against moving parts. So by measuring with what chance they come out with different losses of energy, we can see whether there are parts inside that are moving.
The 20,000 million volt electrons are beamed down the accelerator onto the target tube that has liquid hydrogen running through it. The hydrogen contains the protons to be explored in the experiment. Any electrons that are scattered by parts inside the protons are picked up by huge detectors the size of a house. If the proton had no structure, if it were not made of parts, the electrons would be deflected only slightly during their interaction with it. But if the proton contains small, hard parts, a few electrons should smash the proton and ricochet through large angles.
See a lot of scattering at a big angle, you have the feeling that you're looking at something which is small, which is tiny, because if it's fuzzy, if it's a ball of fuzz, of cotton wool, you expect the particles to go through and not really bounce off. But if there are little bits of something hard inside the cotton wool, you may hit one of those bits and bounce off.
The scattered electrons are guided from the target up into a concrete shielded room that houses the electron detectors. The equipment is set at different angles to record how many electrons come off at large angles of deflection.
What we see is a large amount of scattering at big angles in those events where the electron loses a lot of energy to the proton. Now, the question is, these small things that we bounce off, are they quarks? The answer is they could be quarks. They could also not be quarks. To tell, we have to do more experiments.
Other experiments at Stanford show that the parts inside the proton have a property called spin, and the amount of spin was exactly what the theoreticians had predicted the quarks should carry.
From these experiments, we have found out, or at least we think we found out, that first, that there are indeed parts inside the proton. Secondly, that these parts behave, as nearly as we can see with these instruments, like points, like simple objects. Are they quarks? First, From these experiments, we can tell what the spin of the parts are. And it looks like the spin is a half, which is just the spin we want, according to the theory of quarks. So now we have a chance to look at the quarks. Perhaps even if we can't get them apart, we can look at them in the proton. The real question is, what are the charges? Do they come out of these third integral numbers, as we like to expect, characteristic of quarks? Unfortunately, these experiments give us conjointly a mixture of information on the charge and on the distribution of motions inside the proton. We need another experiment to measure that distribution of motion independently that doesn't depend on the charge. And we have it.
Instead of using electrons to look for quarks, they're now using neutrinos. Billions of them are made in the center of the sun. A neutrino is a truly fantastic, almost ghost-like particle. It has no weight, no electric charge, and can pass through millions of miles of solid matter. It says a lot about the progress of physics that the neutrino discovered only 20 years ago is now being used to look for something else, the quarks. At Geneva, when the accelerator makes neutrinos, all manner of unwanted particles are created at the same time. They're filtered out by a 200-foot-thick steel shield. The seal was borrowed from the Swiss government's emergency reserve. Only the neutrinos will pass through the 3,000-ton steel wall.
This is the rear face of the 3,000-ton steel shield. Every 2 seconds will emerge from it an intense pulse of several billion neutrinos, and they will travel through this machine here, a bubble chamber called Gargamel, which was designed and built by physicists and engineers in Paris and then brought here to CERN 3 years ago.
The occasional collisions that the neutrinos make inside the liquid of the Gargamel chamber should reveal if there are quarks in the protons.
Here we are inside the bubble chamber, which normally contains more than 10 tons of a heavy liquid called freon. We can arrange to expand the liquid at the same time as the pulse of neutrinos comes through the chamber. If one of the neutrinos should interact with a neutron or proton inside the liquid and produce secondary charged particles, they will form bubble tracks in the sensitive liquid. We can observe these with the cameras by illuminating the chamber with an intense flash of light. And under normal operation, we get approximately one neutrino interacting in the chamber for every 30 pulses.
The bubble chamber photographs of the neutrino collisions are precious, so the scientists have their own processing laboratories. Each minute of experimental time produces 240 pictures, and during the course of the whole experiment, some 8 million photographs are taken. These experiments are a collective effort. Each of the 7 groups taking part get their share of pictures to analyze. At University College London, the group led by Dr. Fred Bullock have 1,300,000 pictures to scan. They're looking at particular features of the neutrino collisions. Other groups in the experiment have been searching for evidence of the quarks. From Oxford University, Professor Donald Perkins.
In this picture, one of the neutrinos is interacted at this point here. The neutrino beam comes in along this direction and interacts with a neutron or proton in a nucleus in the liquid. And the characteristic features of this interaction are, first, that a penetrating particle, charged particle, passes out of the chamber in this direction. The proton or neutron, which a neutrino has struck, has recoiled and doesn't generally stay as a proton. New particles will be created so that you'll get a shower of many particles as shown here. The important quantities we want to measure, first of all, are the neutrino energy. We get the neutrino energy by summing the energies of all the charged particles in the event. We can measure their energies by measuring the range of particles which stop, the curvature in the magnetic field of the bubble chamber of particles that leave.
Small armies of scanners make painstaking measurements on the 8 million photographs. It's these measurements which provide the raw data for the analysis. All this careful effort allows the experimenters to calculate the net number of parts inside the proton.
When we do this, we find that we get the number 3, as predicted by the Quark model. The experimental error on this number is about 10 or 20%, but it's sufficiently near to what the Quark model predicts to be very encouraging.
And more encouraging evidence was to come from these experiments. Further analyses of the photographs showed that the electric charges of the parts inside the proton agreed well with those predicted for the quarks. One by one, the predictions for the quarks seem to be verified. So, do quarks exist?
What we have here is a very diverse range of experiments which all seem to be interpretable as, in terms of the neutron and proton being built up very simply from these three quarks. And, of course, the final picture of the nucleon may turn out very different. We may, of course, very well never have the final picture, the final understanding of what a neutron or proton is built from. This is just one short step, hopefully, in the forward direction along a very long road.
Suppose we're right. Suppose all this turns out to be exactly right. Protons are made out of quarks. Quarks have these peculiar charges. They have spin one half. And they act like simple point objects. Then what? What's next? There's plenty next. We still, that would only tell us what the thing is made out of. We still have to figure out how they move around inside, what the laws are that govern the motion of the quarks among themselves, how they're held together, how they behave. This is theoretical physics at the moment. When we get an idea for it, we'll test it by doing experiments. Now, in order to make such a theory, we have some very interesting and very confusing clues, because there are some very peculiar properties that the quarks would have to have in order that this model works. In particular, the first and most obvious and difficult one is that they don't come apart. We've never been able to figure out a model of forces that could hold things together that we wouldn't expect. We have to, of course, agree with other principles of relativity and quantum mechanics. We can't make a system where when we put the things together in little packages, that if we hit them together, the two protons would be hit, the quarks wouldn't come apart. And that's one problem. Second problem is something I can tell you, that if we measure the total momentum of all the quarks inside of a moving proton and add it together, it doesn't add up to 100% of the momentum of the proton. That means there must be something else in there that is not sensitive, is not seen by the electrons and the neutrinos, some kind of neutral object. We already know there'd have to be some other kind of neutral thing inside to hold the quarks together. There must be something to hold the quarks together inside the proton. And not knowing anything about this thing, except that it has to be there in addition to quarks, we don't know what to call this other stuff. We call it some other particles, perhaps called gluons, and we don't know much about the gluons. We have no evidence for them except a negative evidence that they have to exist because things don't add up right, so it's getting a little more complicated. The third feature that's confusing is a little more technical. To understand the atoms, we have had to use a rule. We've understood them by using a rule that no two electrons can actually be in the same state of motion. And the variety of atoms as we go from one number of electrons to another is due to the changing patterns that they all have to have, because each new electron that's put in must go into a state of motion that's different than the ones that were in there before. Now, with the passing of time, we thought we understood the need for this rule. We thought we proved, from relativity principles and quantum mechanical principles and a few other assumptions, that it's necessary that a particle that has spin a half obey this rule that no two can be doing exactly the same thing. But the quark model that we use to understand all these particles suppose that in many situations, the three quarks, say, inside a proton, could be doing exactly the same thing, all doing the same thing. And they have spin a half, so they're disobeying this rule. The cheapest way to get around that, and the only thing we've really thought of that makes any reasonable sense,
is to suppose that when we think the three of them are all doing the same thing, they're really not. That the three of them are different. They're not exactly identical. And that the quark has another property. We could call it color, and that really it's one red quark and one white quark and one blue quark that are doing the same thing. They're not all identical. And so we've complicated the picture once again. We have three times as many types of quarks as we would have thought, plus a gluon. And it turns out a number of different kinds of gluon. So it looks like, even if we get the answer, that it's going to be another expansion of complexity already. And so we have to lead to the next generation, the problem of finding out what the quarks are made out of, or the gluons are made out of. If indeed, that's the way it turns out.
That's the way Horizon intended to end the story of the search for quarks. It's not the end, though, since stop press news overtook us and the physicists struggling to understand what's going on inside the proton. The theory of quarks has been put to a very severe test by some new apparatus at Stanford. The results run counter to the beautiful picture we've built. In this experiment, beams of matter, electrons, were fired at beams of antimatter, positrons.
The electron and positron are particle and antiparticle. Their charges are opposite, their magnetism is opposite, and when you bring them together and make them collide, then all of these properties go away, they cancel out, and what you're left with is a very large amount of energy in a very small region of space. You sort of produce an extremely small, very hot fireball, and from this hot fireball, all of the elementary particles you want to study can be born. They're energy densities that we don't have in other processes in the laboratory, and they're energy densities that don't exist now in the universe either. When I get very poetic about the subject, then I sort of compare those energy densities to what energy densities were like when the universe was young. And if you wave your hands and you manipulate numbers in a little way, then you find that this is kind of comparable to what things were like when the universe was a few seconds old.
The 2-mile-long accelerator fires electrons into the ring where they fly around in a clockwise direction. Then, positrons are injected into the ring in the opposite direction.
They are injected into the machine in such a fashion that they only collide at the two interaction regions where experiments are done. We're standing in one of these interaction regions now. The beams are actually very diffuse, and although there are a lot of particles in them, most times the beams just pass right through each other and nothing happens. About 2,000 or 3,000 times an hour, once a second roughly, an electron finds a positron, they annihilate, make that fireball, and we get the particles that we want to study in the apparatus that's right behind me.
The collisions take place in this cylinder. All around this region are electronic detectors that record what happens. They feed their information to a computer, and playing back the tapes allows the experimenters to simulate what happened after the fireball. The key feature of the results is the number of tracks leaving the central point.
The results are a delight to an experimenter and a plague to a theorist, because the results simply don't agree with anybody's models. Now, here I have to make all of the disclaimers of the academic scientist, and I have to say the results are very preliminary. We just have the data. We've only been analyzing it a little while. But what the results show is quite different from what the quark model predicted.
In essence, far too many particles are produced by each annihilation. No one can yet explain this result, not even the world's most distinguished theoretical physicists. Up to December last year, the picture for the quarks looked very good. The proton contained three simple parts, and the parts seemed to behave as if they were quarks. Have the theoreticians been too anxious to interpret these results in terms of quarks? Do quarks exist at all? Or have these most recent experiments revealed something entirely new in the behavior of matter in extreme situations?
But it's really a very exciting experiment. It's a very exciting time for all of us who are doing it, and also for the theorists who are trying to understand it, because as Feynman once said, you begin to have big advances in elementary particle physics when you have a contradiction. You have a theory which agrees with a whole bunch of data, and along comes another experiment, and this beautiful theory doesn't agree at all, and there sits a contradiction, and now you must resolve it, and in the resolution of that contradiction, you hope to make some major advance in your understanding of nature.
Many people believe, I think, that science is the accumulation of facts, the accumulation of knowledge. But in this kind of fundamental science, the real objective is not just the accumulation of facts, but huge strides in understanding that take place every couple of generations when a grand synthesis is constructed. And it is the hope of seeing in our lifetime such a grand synthesis that drives most of us, I think.